When the Coast Guard car rush initially stopped this vessel, that is when the vessel stopped fishing.
The Coast Guard intercepts a vessel suspected of pirate fishing in the Pacific Ocean. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 8th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Representative Don Young is proposing states take over management of national parks.
We have done studies that the state actually runs the parks better than the federal government.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Coast Guard cutter Rush normally patrols Alaska waters, but it's traveled deep into the Pacific Ocean in pursuit of a suspected pirate fishing vessel. At a Senate hearing in Kodiak on Monday, Coast Guard Commandant Robert Papp said the cutter Rush had intercepted a vessel suspected of high seas drift netting off the coast of Japan. The United Nations moratorium on high seas drift netting is enforced by member states, including the U.S. Coast Guard Chief Petty Officer Keep Wadlow wouldn't say how the cutter Rush ended up on the case, citing an ongoing investigation into the drift net vessel, but he did say the Coast Guard regularly patrols Pacific waters under an agreement with other Pacific Rim nations.
We and our partner agencies are always on patrol and enforcing international law to ensure that fish stocks are being maintained, and if people are out there fishing for them, that they are doing so in a lawful manner.
At the Senate hearing, Commandant Papp said the intercepted vessel was manned by Chinese citizens. He also said Coast Guard officers found 40 tons of illegal fish on board. Wadlow wouldn't confirm that.
When the Coast Guard car Rush initially stopped this vessel for suspicion of engaging in illegal fishing activities, that is when the vessel stopped fishing.
Coast Guard officers have boarded the vessel as part of their investigation, but they haven't been able to take custody of the vessel yet. Wadlow wouldn't explain why that is, but he says the cutter Rush will stay in the Pacific for now to monitor the ship's activity visually and using radar. In the meantime, the agency is coordinating with other countries to decide which one will take the vessel once it is in custody. When the Coast Guard intercepted the stateless fishing vessel Bangun Perkasa last year, the U.S. took control of the vessel. They sailed it to Unalaska, where it's been sitting ever since. The governor's office has proposed nearly $29 million next year to advance his Road to Resources program, which includes $4 million for the planned road to Ambler. That money will be used for permitting and environmental work on the proposed roads, which Governor Sean Parnell says will eventually allow access to resources near Umiat, Tanana, and Ambler. The Brooks Range Council is a grassroots movement opposing the governor's road plan. KNOM's Matthew Smith reports.
The governor calls the roads a chance to grow economic opportunities in rural Alaska and create jobs. But John Gaedeke, the chairman of the Brooks Range Council, says only industry will benefit from the roads.
I think the roads to resources is kind of a misnomer because it sounds like those resources are being made available to Alaskans, but the reality is they're being offered up to people outside of Alaska, and then we're footing the bill with the road, and our wilderness, our way of life, all that has to be sacrificed to pay for these developments.
The Ambler Mining District holds one of the largest undeveloped copper zinc deposits in the world. A study commissioned by the Department of Transportation in September of last year estimated the cost of the Ambler Road to be $430 million, with annual maintenance costs over $8 million. The Brooks Range Council says the true cost would be more than double that figure, and that the high sulfide rock to be mined if the road is built would leach acid into the environment, harming wild fish populations and requiring costly annual cleanup long into the future. Other critics of the road are also becoming more vocal. The community of Bettles in July passed a resolution officially opposing the road. Gaidike says any road should be approved by the people who live there.
These large-scale open-pit mine operations and the roads and infrastructures that they need are so massive. You know, you could literally send a spaceship to Mars with the amount of money that they're talking about spending. And that's supposedly during hard economic times. I would like to see the villagers and the people in the far north of Alaska, you know, look around and say, what do they want?
And to tell the governor what they want, the Brooks Range Council is collecting signatures for a petition calling on the governor to abandon the project.
Signing a letter to the governor sends the message that the development, the so-called progress, is not favorable to everyone. And we're not all just jumping on board for the possibility of more jobs and cheaper fuel. Most of the people that I know out here live out here not because they're looking to have cheaper fuel or more jobs. It's a lifestyle choice. They're living off the land or they're enjoying the independence that living this far out gives you.
So far, the Brooks Range Council hasn't received any official response from the governor's office. If the Ambler Road project stays on schedule, DOT hopes to begin the permitting process for the road in October. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
Representative Don Young wants states to take over management of some national parks. Young, a longtime critic of the National Park Service, says the proposal is a good fit for Alaska, where he says agency regulations unnecessarily limit access.
We would manage the state for Alaskans and, of course, other people. But the idea now is sort of a playground for the Park Service people. And they have these complexes I think are uncalled for, and Alaskans can't use them. And I don't think this is correct. And I'd like to have this apply all across the United States because we have done studies that the state actually runs the parks better than the federal government.
Young says the bill he plans to introduce would provide states with half of the funding the National Park Service gets to manage federal parks and preserves. He says the arrangement would work for many parks in Alaska.
We probably wouldn't take over Denali because it's a big, complex issue. But the idea of Gates of the Arctic, Yukon Charlie, No Attack, these type areas, why not?
Young, who is running for re-election, touted the idea during a visit to Fairbanks on Tuesday. An Alaska case challenging National Park Service authority is working its way through the courts. Central resident Jim Wild is appealing his misdemeanor conviction stemming from a 2010 run-in with park rangers during a boat safety check on the Yukon River. The appeal challenges the Park Service's authority to police navigable waters. Wild's attorney, Bill Satterberg of Fairbanks, says the appeal filed in the Ninth Circuit Court in January has been thrown back to a lower court.
The U.S. government responded and said, well, even though the law allows you to appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, there's some case decisions that say that they can send you back to the district court first. As a result of that, we stipulated, basically refiled back in the district court. The appeal is working its way up the system. It's caught in the dark hole right now, but it is working its way up the system.
Jim Wild refused to cooperate with the rangers who were trying to do a safety inspection on his riverboat where it passes through the Yukon Charlie National Preserve. Navigable rivers like the Yukon are generally under state jurisdiction, but courts have upheld some National Park Service regulatory authority where rivers pass through federal parks and preserves. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Samoan residents in Anchorage take to the city's softball fields for some lively competition.
Samoan people, you know, we're big people, but we like to be physical, you know, get out and play games. And so that's what a lot of people are here to do.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The fire that destroyed the original Matanuskame Dairy Warehouse in Palmer on Tuesday took a piece of Alaska's history. The building dates to 1935, when the original Matanuska Valley colonists settled in Alaska, and has been on the Alaska Association for Historic Preservation's list of endangered historic properties for several years. Judy Bittner, the state's historic preservation official, says the destruction of the building represents a big loss to the state's history and to the people of Palmer. The property was in private ownership by Anchorage attorney William Ingleson. Palmer Public Safety Director John Owen said yesterday that the city had not purchased the property, although there were plans to do so.
The building was uninsured.
The Anchorage Daily News reports the value of the building at $380,600. The cause of the fire has not been determined. Teachers are doing a good job, students are eager to succeed, and parents are invested in what's going on. But the Sitka School District needs to make sure all three of those groups are on the same page when it comes to math education. That's the finding of an audit on the way Sitka teaches math. The $18,000 project was commissioned by the Sitka School District last year. Results were presented to the school board on Monday. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
In early December, a team of three researchers from Texas A&M University visited Sitka. They observed 11 teachers across various grade levels, held focus groups with students and parents, conducted surveys, and digested tons of data. The result is a 55-page document that looks at how the district is teaching math from kindergarten through 12th grade and what can be done to strengthen it. The report uses a lot of educational terminology, so I asked for some help.
Hello?
Hi, Dr. Caprero.
That's Caprero, actually. Robert Caprero, an associate professor in the mathematics department at Texas A&M. He is one-third of the team that wrote Sitka's math audit.
So what we did was we looked at how the students had been doing over a prolonged period of time. We also looked at what the curriculum was during that period of time. And we looked at how the teachers were enacting the curriculum.
And one of the big things they found was that there was not a lot of vertical and horizontal alignment in what was being taught. What does that mean? Well, horizontal alignment means teachers in the same grade are teaching similar things at the same time.
If that kid gets stuck with homework or there's a problem the kid doesn't understand, parents can then talk to each other. And they have a child in the same grade, then they can be helpful to each other. The parents can be helpful to each other. The kids can be helpful to each other. And it facilitates that informal learning environment.
Vertical alignment, on the other hand, makes sure that what's being taught in third grade is enough to make kids ready for fourth grade. This is math we're discussing, so here's an example.
Let's talk about fractions. If I'm the teacher who's supposed to be teaching adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing by fractions, then I got to make sure that the teacher who had them before me really taught the idea of partitioning wholes.
You know, partitioning wholes, cutting a pan of brownies into equal pieces. Anyway, the idea is that one grade's lessons should feed into the next, and that within a grade, everyone is on the same metaphorical page. The researchers wrote that classroom visits were fruitful and that teachers were really good at working with all of their students. But the report also says the district would benefit from giving them more professional development and from finding better ways to measure student success. The report also cites feedback from students and parents.
We had a lot of questions for parents about what they saw happening in schools, what they saw with teachers. They were incredibly complimentary of the teachers.
But they had less complimentary things to say about textbooks. Only 29% of parents said that they were happy with the textbooks. Some said they could not help their students with homework because the books were not clear or didn't have examples. One parent reported using Google instead of the book to find easier ways to figure out problems, and even parents who said that they're comfortable with math reported having difficulty with their child's book.
So there was a lot of pressure on the audit team to make a curriculum recommendation to either stay or change.
But Caprero says it's not the role of the audit team to support or condemn whichever materials a district is using. That said, they did point out that switching materials comes with its own set of problems.
There are huge people costs as well as dollar costs for changing a curriculum.
Caprero says there are free materials out there.
And they're about worth what you pay for them.
And he says the others cost anywhere from $30 per student to adopt on up to $500 or $600 per student. And then there's what he calls the people cost.
When you have to retrain a faculty in order to implement a new curriculum effectively, you have to basically teach those teachers how to teach that curriculum. So there's a whole year where instead of focusing on teaching children, they're working on teaching themselves.
Nor, he says, will it work to just slap new materials in front of teachers and shout go. In the very last paragraph of the report, the auditors write that poor execution of good material is the same as good execution of terrible material. As an analogy, they write, the best captain with the best crew, most state-of-the-art equipment, and best electronics money can buy, who fishes in a bathtub, is not going to catch any fish. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Some black bears, especially those on the coast of British Columbia, carry a genetic anomaly that makes their fur white. They're popularly called spirit bears. KSTK's Ann Hillman spoke to bear biologist Wayne McCrory, who has been studying the bears and trying to protect them for the past 30 years. He says they could be facing a new, larger threat.
According to a legend from some of the First Nations people of British Columbia, the white-faced black bears were created as a reminder.
And there's a beautiful legend about the spirit bear that comes from the Tsimshians. And it goes along the lines that Raven, the creator, went to this island, which we know today as Prince's Royal Island. And he went amongst all of the black bears, and he created every 10th one white as a reminder of the last ice age. It's a beautiful, captivating legend that speaks, I think, of oral history and native presence on the coast for thousands of years, going back to recognition of the ice age.
That's biologist Wayne McCrory with Valhalla Wilderness Society, a conservation group in British Columbia. He started studying the Cromarty black bears almost 30 years ago. He says it's unclear exactly how many white-faced black bears are in the wild, but studies suggest about 300 to 400 carriers of the white-faced gene live in a concentrated area on the coast of BC. The gene is recessive, meaning mothers of any color can have white cubs so long as both parents are carriers of the gene. McCrory says that one behavioral study shows that white bears may have an advantage when fishing.
The white Cromarty bears caught more salmon because, especially during the gray daylight hours, the white bear was more camouflaged against the background sky than was the black bear to the fish in the stream. So it was much easier for white Cromartys to catch salmon.
They weren't always called spirit bears. Local people called them moskmal, which means white bear, but it's hard to pronounce. The Japanese call them ghost bears, but local people don't believe in ghosts. The unusual white bears were eventually dubbed spirit bears because the First Nations people and conservationists wanted them to be known by a name everyone could relate to. They used the bears as a mascot to protect the Great Bear Rainforest from excessive logging. Now the bears are an emblem for a new fight, the opposition to the proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline. If the project goes through, 220 tankers filled with heavy tar sands oil, called bitumen, and the toxic condensate used to liquefy it, would pass by the bear's home every year. McCrory says a major spill in that area, especially near Gribble Island, where many of the spirit bears live, could devastate their population.
All of the bears that use the island would use the shoreline at some point during their annual life cycle. So a major spill would quickly oil the whole shoreline, you know, significantly, and the bears would get contaminated by oil in a number of ways. They would get it from just walking along the oil shoreline and getting it on their fur, and then trying to lick the oil off their fur and suffering toxic effects.
He says they would also ingest spilled oil through contaminated mussels, fish, and marine mammals. Enbridge is the company proposing the pipeline. Their communications manager, Todd Nogier, says the company would implement a comprehensive safety program for the project when shipping in Canadian waters.
This would include the use of only modern double-hulled tankers. They would be independent BC pilots who would be boarding each tanker. Each tanker would be vetted by a third-party agency before gaining port. All crews must be International Marine Organization or IMO certified. And all laden tankers would be connected to a tugboat, so they would be tethered to a tugboat.
He says the tugs would carry emergency response equipment, and that all of the tankers would be inspected for corrosion by a third party before being allowed near the coast. For McCrory, those promises aren't enough.
We are predicting with considerable confidence that any tanker traffic there is a very high risk, not only to bears on the whole central coast, but in particular to the mother island of the white bear.
He's working with other conservationists and First Nations groups to try to raise awareness of the bears and the proposed pipeline's potential effects. He spoke in Wrangell during last month's Bear Fest. In Wrangell, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Do you know a nonprofit executive or tribal leader who is at risk for job burnout? We'll nominate them for a Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical, which provides paid time away for personal renewal and growth. Go to Rasmussen.org for more information, but don't wait. Nominees must complete an application by October. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This year's Neltjena caribou herd population is at an unexpected high, and the Department of Fish and Game issued an additional 2,425 hunting permits in an effort to keep the population within a manageable range, APRN's Wendy Jonathan reports.
The Neltjena caribou population has been steadily increasing over the last few decades. Becky Schwanke, an area biologist with the Department of Fish and Game, says that the count bounced between 40,000 and 44,000 the last few years. And she says they counted over 46,000 animals this year.
So this was a little of a surprise. We thought that the herd was a little bit lower based on last year's count, but the count this year came out just, you know, a little higher than we expected.
Over the last 2 years, Schwanke says the caribou herd has been at peak productivity with higher numbers of calves being born than she's seen in a long time. And when that happens, it eventually swells the population numbers.
We had some apparently better than expected survival the last couple years on all of our age classes, including our calves.
Even though the population boom indicates excellent environmental conditions, there is a limit to the number of animals the ecosystem can hold. Schwanke says that wildlife managers try to keep the population between 35,000 and 40,000. If not, she says they will overforage and wreak long-term damage on the environment.
A lot of what happens is there's trampling. There's just too many animals in a small section of space, and so it just tends to result in plants that get damaged for the long term. Lichens are one of those species that get hurt tremendously by trampling.
To deal with the extra animals, Schwanke says the Department of Fish and Game issued extra hunting permits. The Neltjena caribou herd is located in a 23,000 square mile range on the edge of the Chugach Mountains. It is one of the only caribou herds that is accessible by the Alaskan highway system, making it very popular for hunters. Schwanke is hoping that the extra hunters will help keep the population in moderate levels.
I hope that folks are able to get out and take full advantage of the additional hunting opportunity this year without overcrowding, and, you know, hopefully folks maintain pretty high level of ethics when they're out there and understanding there's going to be a lot of folks in the field this year.
Subsistence hunting and community harvest hunts are allowed with permits. The Department of Fish and Game also issues permits after random drawings, but all the additional permits have already been issued for this season. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonathan.
The Samoan population in Anchorage more than doubled between 2000 and 2010, and as the community has grown rapidly, so has its presence on the city's softball fields. Samoan churches in Anchorage run co-ed softball tournaments throughout the summer as a way to bring the community together. And as APRN's Annie Fite found out, the atmosphere is friendly, but the competition is fierce.
According to the 2010 census, 5,953 Samoan people live in Anchorage, and it seems like half of them must be at the Carti Field Complex in East Anchorage on a recent night. The place is packed.
If you're looking for any Samoan, you find them all here at the league.
I find Longi Simiota in the batter's box on the edge of one of the fields. She used to play for her family's team, Big Blue, but an injury forced her onto the sidelines. Now she's a cheerleader, a position she appears to take very seriously. Simiota says the games are friendly, but not too friendly.
You know, Samoans are very competitive people, yeah. So this is where they get to show off.
Big Blue is undefeated in the tournament, and Simiota and the other cheerleaders want to make sure it stays that way.
Yep, that's our cheers.
Ali Masala-Sala is another cheerleader. She's been cheering for Big Blue since the tournament first started in 2005. Back then, Big Blue was one of only three Samoan softball teams in Anchorage. Now there are 22. Masala-Sala says the expansion has been good for the community.
Because when we're not doing this, there's a lot of division between the churches. But when we come together like this, it brings us together and stuff, so It's kind of good for the summer.
The summer tournaments are organized by Samoan churches in Anchorage. Moi Tali is pastor at MCA Island Revival. He's also a team coach and pitcher. He says cricket is a favored sport back in Samoa, an influence from New Zealand, which occupied the country until 1962. And Pastor Moy says softball requires pretty much the same qualities.
That athleticism, I mean, you just give us a bat and a ball, we'll figure out how to play with it.
The teams are all co-ed, and Pastor Moy says the tournaments emphasize good sportsmanship.
So, and that's the idea, you know, because you can be in church, but once you're out on the field, the beast comes out.
A batter hits a ball into the outfield and two runners start rounding the bases. At the Cartier Complex, there are four main softball fields. Tournament games are underway at all of them, except one field where Preston Agaufa is sitting on the bench, his one-year-old daughter on his lap.
We are just waiting to play. It's kind of that Samoan time I've been telling you about. Game's supposed to start at 7:30, and I'm not sure what time it is. It's got to be about 8:10.
With both teams ready to play, Agaufa isn't sure why they're waiting, but he appears patient. His team is also undefeated in the tournament. He says it's great to see how Samoan softball has grown in Anchorage over the years.
Samoan people, you know, we're big people, but we like to be physical, you know, get out and play games, and so that's what a lot of people are here to do.
Agaufa's team members are also his family. They attend a Mormon church in Anchorage. Many other teams are from Pentecostal churches, but Agaufa says the tournament brings everyone together.
Samoan people and different religions, they can be pretty territorial and antisocial, but this event has kind of bridged the gap between a lot of that and a lot of churches that historically wouldn't necessarily get along That's the opposite here in Alaska. We get along, we have a good time. We see each other in off seasons and we say, okay, man, can't wait to softball, you know.
Across the park, Big Blue is celebrating another win. And as the players come off the field, the cheerleaders launch into a victory song. But just because the game is over doesn't mean the team is ready to head home. Instead, they eat Samoan pancakes and socialize with other teams. Never mind that the tournament is scheduled to start up again early the next morning. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in on Alaska, Matthew Smith in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Ann Hillman in Wrangell. APRN's Wendy Jonasson reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.